Welcome to Thursday. It's the Progressive Radio Network. The show is Insight. My name happens to be Mark Farrell. Mark Farrell, if you like the show, and Juan Valdez, or something along the lines, if you don't like the show. How about that? It's a hot one in New York City today. Absolutely. It's hot for many reasons. It's hot, and many people are hot under the collar because it's a summer of hell for those commuting by train from New Jersey and also Long Island because, you know, there's a little thing called track maintenance. It's been overlooked for maybe a decade or two or three or five or since the dawn of time. So they got to do so much track work that for two months, tracks are closed. A minor inconvenience. Minor. God, will the MTA ever get blown up? I shouldn't say those words, blown up. It needs a complete overhaul. Get those people out of there. It's so hot in New York City today on a different level that when you get one of those subway cars that, you know, once in a while, like maybe five cars out of like 12 or so are so cold you can hang a side of beef in them. And you don't want to give up that car, that subway car, even to just go out to the city to get fresh air because it's not fresh air. It's humidity. It's gross. It's nasty. So it's so hot that you don't want to give up that car, even if someone's like mildly groping you or there's a little exposure going on in a car, because you'll overlook that just to stay cold, right? It's so hot in New York City today that the Statue of Liberty, the pride and glory of our nation, who always depicts class, has pit stains. I never thought that could be possible, but she pulls it off. She wears it well. She does wear it well. And lastly, I think it's so hot in New York City, we can possibly consider overlooking, again, possibly consider overlooking, Chris Christie wearing shorts. No, I take that back. We cannot overlook him wearing shorts because that's just something, a sight that my 8-year-old son in the next room should never have to see. Got a great show coming your way. Funny things like that and more. You're going to meet a great, great, talented woman, Sophia Cheyenne, who's brought so much goodness and happiness and positivity to this world and to the people she comes in touch with that it was a must to have her on the show. And she's sitting a few feet away from me. She's completely drenched in sweat. Can we have that bucket of ice for Sophia, please? Okay, it's coming up. So we don't mess around here at the Gary Null Radio, Progressive Radio Network. See, we drained the hot tub and we filled it with ice. So it's, you know, like the ice bucket challenge. Well, we took that a step further. So when it's hot out in New York City, you know, the air conditioning just can't keep up the way it needs to because it's only trying to keep, what, during a weekday, maybe 15 to 20 million people cold? Yeah. Okay. So it's not going to happen. So she's hanging out with her feet in the ice tank, and we'll meet Sophia in a few minutes. Until then, we got some really compelling stuff, as we always do, because, you know, that's what we do here so well. So, I woke up this morning, which was a good thing, at 3:45, did my spin class and everything. Then I read what I like to do, what most of you guys, I'm sure, do, you know, read the headlines for today. And I read that David Wildstein, that name rings a bell, right? He was the kind of the self-proclaimed mastermind of Bridgegate. So he has managed to escape any jail time, spared by a federal judge. And the reason why, and by the way, just to refresh your memory here, that he was actually grade school pals with Chris Christie. It would be interesting to find out what his dietary intake was, Chris Christie, when he was, how big his lunch bag was. Okay, I'm sorry, I digress. So David Wildstein will not serve any time. He was the mastermind. He, again, admitted this. The federal judge said, since you cooperated so well and gave up Bill Baroni and Bridget Ann Kelly, that we're going to allow you to skate. Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, he's got to do some serious time, 500 hours of community service, blah, blah. Really, really tough work. And oh, yeah. There's 3 years probation. So what does that mean? I mean, the guy's not going to do anything wrong. I mean, what could he do? I mean, it would be a white collar crime. He was at max going to serve 27 months in prison. But I think this is just a farce. This is the biggest crock that Bill Baroni, he's the deputy executive director, former of the Port Authority. He was sentenced to 2 years. And Bridget Ann Kelly, deputy chief of staff, who is a mother of two, maybe three, sentenced to 18 months. So these are the fall people, Bill and Bridget. And I cannot fathom that, yes, I know we are all very intelligent and realize that money, power, and politics go hand in hand. But it's still, when rulings come down like this, it just is so black and white, so palpable, the injustice there, that, okay, they realized it was deemed lawbreaking. But David Weinstein, just because he sang and gave up two other people, they were the underlings. They acted accordingly. I mean, they were told by their superiors what to do. Now, could they have said, no, I don't agree with this. I think it's ethically and morally and humanitarily wrong? Yes. Would they have been fired? Who knows? I'm sure the lawsuit they could have conjured up would have been in their favor. But the reality is that I just think the fallout here, the outcome is extremely lopsided. That the top gets nothing. Of course, Chris Christie, whew, totally skates. But I think in January of 2018, when he's free, to sit on the beach, strike that from your memory and recall of that picture, that he won't be sitting out certainly at the beach in Island State Beach Park, the governor's other mansion. But when he's free, and I think other people, Bridget Ann Kelly and Bill Baroni, and possibly David Weinstein down the road, I think the dirt's really going to come out. Because obviously we know Christie's headed into the White House, not to run for when Trump gets impeached. He's not going to run for next term. He's basically going to try to, because his legacy right now, he's creating the opioid epidemic, which is, again, very, very serious. And I understand earmarking a great deal of money and time, but that is what he's riding full force until the end of his term. So I think he's going to take that initiative and parlay it into the national initiative, which Trump is spearheaded. And I'm not sure who's running that initiative right now, but I think that's going to be his gateway into the White House. So it'd be interesting to find out if any of that comes out prior to him getting appointed and or when he gets into office under whatever position to fight the drug opioid epidemic, that he will lose his position due to information that'll be surfaced. And I think it will surface because I think at this point it's just really hard not to be, especially when his approval rating is the worst of any kind in history, certainly in New Jersey and possibly, I think, in the history of the United States. Of all the state, New Jersey, or all the United States governors, which is pretty remarkable. Anyway, to be continued, right? It's about 7 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock in New York City. Thanks so much for listening to the Progressive Radio Network each and every Thursday. Always love to hear your input. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And you know, I'm very vocal about mental health. There's a great expression, and actually I had to possibly ask my guest this in a few minutes. There's an Indian proverb, Native American proverb, about mental health in terms of opening, it's in a metaphor, opening certain doors in your mind every day, if not to really think, just to air things out. And I'll have to look that up. I just thought about it as I was going into this segment, that you know the importance of mental illness that I always talk about. I speak about it publicly on stage, and it's something I feel very, very dear and close to my heart because not only did I lose my brother to suicide, that I went through my own anxiety, depression, episodes of that nature. So it's very, very important, especially for men to talk about because, you know, I did not talk about it because I was a man. I just didn't talk about it for a few years because I thought it was just something near and dear and private. But then as I, you know, my speaking business evolved, et cetera, and I would get off stage after speaking about this at conventions and seminars, guys immediately would come up to me, zoom, beeline right up to me and be like, thank God, thank you for doing what you do for men. And then I was like realizing how palpable and how strong of a message it is for people in general to understand the taboos and about mental illness and to break down those walls and barriers. But even more so for men, because men are perceived as a source of strength, et cetera. And not in my world, because I was raised in a very liberal environment. So it's not so much the man was the breadwinner, even though my father was predominantly until my siblings were older. But so that wasn't the traditional household for the most part. when I was growing up. And then it changed because my parents got divorced. My mother was very independent, bought her own house, raised the kids, et cetera, worked 2-3 jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very important topic to me. And I just wanted to point this out to you because this is very cool that a woman who has a high-powered job at a technical firm, didn't name the actual company, but she actually sent an email out to her colleagues recently and said that I'm taking a few days off for mental health. And we all joke about that. Like if you say, oh, you know, if I say to Kelsey, the board operator here, Kelsey, you're not going to see me tomorrow because I need a day off for mental health. Ah, ha, 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 check it off. You know, and that's what we kid around about. But, there, you know, there are certain people, certainly a lot of us, me included, who would have needed those days and time. That so she did. She put it out there. And her name is Madeline. What's Madeline's last name? Madeline, where are you? Madeline, it'll come to me. I'll find it once I can read my writing. Parker. So she sent out this email and said, you know, she's not going to be there for a few days. And so basically, I guess the technical CEO responded to that. And he said, thank you for your transparency and openness. So I'm not exactly sure how the email was sent to her, sent to the CEO, disseminated, et cetera. But Madeline tweeted out many, many different things, her response to Ben Coglinton, the CEO. And it just proves that once you put something out there, it starts a national conversation, which is great about the importance of, you know, the reluctance of employers to recognize mental health as, you know, a serious component of their employees, that they should be able to stay home. If you're taking a sick day, I mean, do you have to lie and say I had a cold? I had a stomach flu. I had Chinese food last night, and it was, and you're like, oh, no, stop the story right there. We don't need to hear any more about your stomach flu from ordering bad Chinese food. But it's great. So it's in the last couple of days, it's gone a lot. I mean, virally, it's gone, you know, crazy. And I think it's very warranted because it's a valid reason to stay home. So she's quoted by saying that she wrote that, hang on. She wrote that she was too distracted by my mental health to be effective at work and too worried about work to be effective at self-care. Really well said, Madeline. I really like that. I think that's to the point and so true because when I was experiencing anxiety, and depression. I was conducting interviews with, you know, some major players, celebrities, etc. And I remember just being in my studio, just sweating profusely. And, you know, I didn't tell anybody. My family knew. And I was just sweating. And, you know, your mind is hard to focus on, concentrate, etc. And I would just be like, oh, my God, let me just get through this interview, etc., etc. And I remember a camera crew from NBC in there. I was interviewing Sue Simmons from News Channel 4. And I always idolized her, and I thought she was great. She left the station about 5 years ago, I think shortly after she dropped an F-bomb. But her demise was kind of she's a great, tremendous broadcaster, her and Chuck Scarborough. Anyway, she's in my studio, and I was at the kind of the tail end of anxiety and panic and stuff like that, but I'm still sweating profusely because I wore a suit. Obviously, well-deserved for interviewing such a prominent, worldwide known journalist. So anyway, I just remember sitting there going like, oh my God, as much as I was eager for this interview, I was also very excited to end the interview. So there's two or three cameras in a very small studio. The lights, I mean, it was hot. And I think it only ended up being 25-minute interview, actually, which was nice because I aired a segment of it on News Channel 4 and News at 11, which was very, very cool. But I just one of the many times I remember being in a situation like that. But my call to duty was I'm never going to let this win. And that's what I did. Even on my worst days, you know, not telling anybody, I just was like, this is my battle and I'm not going to let it overtake me. Even if I, you know, just have to, obviously I'm not totally myself and I didn't conduct the best of interviews, but the preparation was there and I probably wasn't as light as I would normally be and, you know, humorous, et cetera. But I did my job and I got done what I had to do. And then I was just like, you know, I felt like $1 million after I left the place because just the pressure was off. But my reality was, and it worked for me, is that the beast, I call it the beast would not win I was going to win over the beast. I would be triumphant. And that's what I was. Obviously, seeking help and assistance, et cetera, worked and, you know, incredibly, exponentially well. But that was my mantra, and that's what worked for me. So I'm just glad that Madeline put that out there for the world to have that conversation. And more importantly, for an employer of a big company to realize that, yes, you know what? My employees are human beings. Yes, I want them to crank out, whether it's widgets, ideas, the numbers that they seek, the board to please the board of directors, Wall Street, etc. But the reality is, for them to do all that, they have to be healthy. And speaking of healthy, here is something that I read about that brought me back to my years in college in a good way and in a very bad way. Have you heard about this? This is called Coco Loco. No, it's not something you drink. It's something you snort. Caffeine-laced inhalable food. Yeah, can I have a steak, medium rare, mashed potatoes? Oh, yeah. Can you dry that up and put some cocoa in it and crystallize it, cut it up so I can break out the straw? Yeah, I want my straw like 3 or 4 inches on a 45-degree angle so I can just have a meal. And feel good and get those endorphins going, increase my serotonin. I mean, that's what it's all about, right? I mean, that's the world we live in. We don't have to have meals prepared or go out to restaurants. Let's just live on Coco Loco. So here's the deal. I'm kidding about this, but that's the reality. It's caffeine-laced inhalable food, okay? And this came out, about 6 months ago. And the fear is, it's going to be used way too much and way too wrongfully to get a high. So thankfully, someone has taken the FDA on. Chuck Schumer, I think, is the Senate Minority Leader. He has said basically, and this is a gray line, this is cocaine on training wheels. That's it. I mean, come on. Why would you get kids, and that's who they're targeting, to start this act? Because why would they think it's much of a leap to go from Coco Loco to cocaine or whatever else they want to call it, because it'll lessen the blow and thinking it's not that much of a giant step? It's made by a company called Legal Lean. Right there, Legal Lean tells you something weird, right? So for 10 mere servings, you can see like the infomercial at 3 a.m. Just for 10 mere servings, it's $24.99. Order now in the next 10 minutes, and the operator that you'll speak to will give you free 5 extra servings of Coco Loco, just for the asking. So it promises euphoric energy, calm focus, and rush. So how can you have euphoric energy and calm focus and rush of endorphins and serotonin all at the same time? That's just very contradictory. So the health results or risk are very unknown, but the FDA approved this. How can they approve something of this nature? Unless Legal Lean has made a major, major contribution to somebody, lobbyists, et cetera, et cetera. So you know how that works out, right? So it kind of brings me back to my stories in college when I had a little bit too much time on my hands, freshman year. I was only taking 3 classes because I was admitted to college on a probationary status because my grades weren't that good because I couldn't see the chalkboards, I didn't test well, et cetera, all to my visual impairment. So I was happy to be accepted on a part-time basis, probationary basis, because once I proved myself, I would be able to take on a full load the next semester, et cetera, and prove to the world and more importantly myself that yes, despite a disability, a visual impairment, that I too can function well and exercise my brain and do cocaine as well. So I had all that free time the first semester, and that's how I got into a little bit of trouble. I wish I had Coco Loco back then because maybe things would have turned out differently. But it just goes to prove to you that that's the kind of the state of mind that our society is in, especially for developers, food developers, and people in the diet industry. Everyone's always looking for that quick fix. You know, the reality is you have to watch your intake. You know, your body's a filter. What you put in is going to have results, either good results or harmful results, weight gain, et cetera. So, but we're always, and since the dawn of time, looking for that easy out to realize and or to make a an easier way to lose and or maintain weight besides just watching what you put into your body and or dieting, exercising. I mean, we all have diets, whether it's a good diet or a bad diet. It's funny, this morning when I was teaching my spin class, there was a woman that sits in front of me, and about a month ago, I got a whiff of coffee. I'm like, wow. I said, is somebody drinking coffee? And the woman in front of me smiles. She has two water bottles. One of them's transparent. You can see it's water. And the other one's like, a thermos-like. And she waves her hand. She goes, I am. I said, are you kidding me? Wait. We're going to have some drug testing after this class. Okay, dope testing, because you're performing very well, and you admitted to having something in that thermos. So anyway, she says she drinks coffee as well as water when she's doing spin. So it's pretty funny that we've become so indoctrined and conditioned to have things of that nature, even during a workout. You know, I see people sometimes in a gym, it's not widespread like it used to be, that walk out of the gym and then they come back a few minutes later. I'm like, you know, but they're going out to smoke a cigarette. I know people who work at gyms who, you know, consider their bodies temples, which they should, who go outside and smoke and come back. I'm like, you know, you're a walking contradiction. What do you mean? I said, you're a personal trainer, man. You're telling people what to do and what not to do. And this is only obviously people I know and I can, you know, speak to them like this. But, you know, you really should be setting a better example. And more importantly, take care of yourself, man. Don't be smoking like that. Anyway. That's Mark Farrell getting off his high horse, walking a little funny because I was on a horse for a few minutes. Anyway, I'd like to introduce you to someone very special, and it's all going to come back to the spin class because lately it has been. Sophia Cheyenne is an incredible person. We spoke on the phone a couple days ago, and I said to her, listen, you know, pre-interview calls are usually something that obviously is a requirement because somebody who has a vast past and or interesting background, as an interviewer, you always want to ask questions that you pretty much know the answer to. And that's why you have pre-interview calls, either the producer does or myself. But anyway, I said to her, man, this is great. I'm really looking forward to having you on for many, many reasons. And number one, just because of your sweet, effervescent disposition and just passion to live life. Welcome to the show, Sophia Cheyenne.
Thank you so much, Mark. I'm so, so excited to be here.
Well, hi.
I mean, it's just always great to share stories and meet people like you. I admire you and all your work, too.
Thank you so much. So yeah. After the show, do you want to get some Coco Loco?
Why not?
Hey, it's New York City. If they don't have Coco Loco here, then you can't find it anywhere. I mean, come on, right?
It's true.
So now, the reason why you're on the show is for many reasons. You love the arts. You're a dancer. You sit on a board. You co-chair. You teach people. Mm-hmm. And this all kind of started because of your life. When you were born, how much did you weigh when you were born?
I was actually pretty average weight, about 8 pounds.
8 pounds, yeah. That is average weight. But your mother, very shortly after your birth, was handed a picture that you said to me, quote unquote, that your mother basically said it looked like a picture of an animal because the doctor and or genetic specialist said that your daughter is a dwarf and this is most likely what her life is going to be like.
Right.
Oh, congratulations. Have a nice day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she was, what had happened, what made them look twice, because my limbs were somewhat average and I was smaller, but nothing that really like struck anyone until my heartbeat was a little fast. And that's sort of what made them look twice. And that was kind of how that diagnosis ended up being made. But yeah, she got given this photo that was apparently very scary looking and, she was like, that's not my daughter, you know? And yeah, they were like, you know, she has this dwarfism. It's called spondyloepiphyseal dysplasia congenital. And she's probably going to have lots of issues. This is the little information we have about it. Go find Little People of America. Good luck, you know? And that was all she got.
Oh, by the way, sign on the form here because you're responsible for anything the insurance company doesn't pay.
Yeah.
But you know what's funny about this, and sad, I should say, more importantly, is that if it was 1940, maybe 1950, you know, maybe a little around that area, you would kind of understand because that's what they did back then. There wasn't a lot of knowledge. But you're only 26 years young.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that long ago.
No.
1990?
Yeah, 91.
91. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what was happening. And you said that you were, your mom was actually on the luckier ones because there was a genetic counselor on the floor.
Yes. Yes. There are some little people that get diagnosed later on in life or get misdiagnosed because there is that lack of information. Doctors kind of assume that it's the one and the most common type. because they don't actually know the difference between the features of the different dwarfisms.
Which there are over 200 variations
yes.
of.
Yes.
That's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And, like, I go to the conventions every summer, or I try to when I can, and you see all the different types in one place, and it really is quite amazing.
How well-versed is the average person who has one of these conditions? Are they aware of... Obviously, they're aware of their own condition, but would they look at someone else and be like, oh, they have condition X or condition Y or Z?
I think that really depends on how much you're exposed to Little People of America, the organization. Myself, I definitely could tell the difference between lots of different types. And it's usually features like the hands and the back and legs and stuff like that. But most people, I mean, sometimes they're just like, yeah, that's just another dwarf, you know?
So growing up obviously had its fair share of challenges, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
School?
Yeah.
Bullied between K through 8th grade?
Yes. Yeah,
tough
yeah.
Tough years.
It was very tough in the beginning. It's funny because I don't actually think I ever remember the moment that I knew I was different. It was really what other people were giving me that made me feel different. Myself, my family, they never really made it a thing until I went to school and I was treated differently by teachers and by peers that I was like, oh, wow, I guess I am a little shorter than everyone. And, you know, starting to piece those things together. But at first, yeah.
Now, it's kind of a good thing because your parents treated you like any other kid, which they should.
Definitely.
Like your other sibling. You have one sibling, correct?
I do. I have a younger brother, and he's 6'3".
Oh, my God.
He's really
You guys must have a good time together.
Yeah, we do. We're very close. I love him so much, yeah.
So that must have been interesting growing up, obviously, and it's very, very, very normal. And I don't like to use the word normal.
Yeah, neither
very
do I.
Very common to to have a dwarf child from average height parents.
Yes, yes.
One would think, you know, common sense, oh, genetically, there's probably a reason there, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very common. Most little people are born from average height families because it's just a kind of a genetic mutation. It's a spontaneous thing that happens. Sometimes, you know, all cases are different. But for the most part, yeah, most of us have average height parents.
So when you came home with experiencing a bad day, which everybody has, for being targeted for your size, what words of encouragement would your parents have for you?
Yeah. You know, I really didn't ever express that I was having trouble at school with my parents when I was younger. It really wasn't until high school where I think I was able to kind of come into my own and then realize all of the bullying that had happened.
Is that a form of processing? You think it took a long time?
I think so. I think so. Definitely. Because what it was, there were definitely name calling. I luckily was never physically pushed around and stuff. That was definitely not what happened. But it was more of like a social name calling, you know, verbal sort of bullying that happened. And just sort of like separated. I always felt separated from everyone else.
Sure, which, I mean, it's very common for that age.
Yeah.
Obviously, but when it's very obvious to the eye.
Yeah.
For example, when I was in school, it wasn't obvious that I was visually impaired because for all intents and purposes, I don't walk into walls, only if I'm doing too much Coco Loco. but I got bullied for that reason because obviously I couldn't do sports, couldn't read boards and test, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But yes, when it's a little bit more obvious, and I tell people everybody has a disability, whether it's obvious or not, you know, it's what we do in life. You don't want to sit on sidelines of life. You know, you want to do and make modifications to whatever you need to do so you can enjoy life, man.
Yeah.
You know, and
Yeah, no, my parents really, they did such an amazing job with me and my brother, as far as bringing us up and encouraging us to be who we want and do what we want and not be afraid to take risks in life. We were talking about advice earlier, and one of the things that always sticks with me that my mother said to me was, you are allowed 17 minutes on the pity pot, and that's it. And
per day?
Yeah. I mean, depending on how many episodes you have, I guess.
Sure.
But yeah, she always said that to me. And it was because sometimes, you know, if I did come home and I was upset about something, I'm a very emotional person. I would cry. That was sort of how I expressed my frustration.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. And they did let me do that too. It was good to cry. It was good to be open and talk about what was hard and yeah, but she always was like, 17 minutes. You're only allowed 17 minutes. And she would time me. And then by the time we would talk during that time, and by the time it was 7 minutes in, I was fine, you know. And it was just this little thing that I always stick with. And sometimes I even tell other people about, because I think it's kind of helpful to think about it as like a, you know, this pot that once it's over 17 minutes, you fall in. And then it's really hard to get out, you know.
It seems like the sides of the buckets are not within reach,
right?
You know, because it's great to purge, and we all have to purge and get this off our chest and in a daily and or weekly, however, when it's needed, deemed necessary. But yeah, you can wallow in it. We all know people who are those dark clouds who just live in that. And you know what? There's plenty of reasons why you could stay there, but there are more and better reasons not to.
Yeah,
because the more time you spend there, going back to that proverb, I can't remember. I think the less spend time you'll need to spend there,
right?
Because you're just doing. It's like going to the gym and just eating properly, and just that, you know, you're keeping things tuned up.
Yeah, and if you practice that positive thinking and you know that uplifting. For yourself, mm-hmm. you know, it does become a habit that
you
can live by.
Absolutely.
You know?
So at a very, very young age, you started playing the piano?
No, dancing.
Dancing.
Yeah.
3 years old?
Yeah.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first thing my parents really got me into was dance. I loved it. I enjoyed the costumes and being on stage and, you know, making friends too in that way. But also just to feel like I was moving and working
free.
Yeah. And really being able to express myself. I also, because I was of smaller than others, like I was able to do things that other people couldn't do. My spins were always super fast, or I was able to be lifted in cool different ways, you know, and that kind of made it special, you know. It made it something that I was like, oh, I have this special thing.
So it's always
really
nice
cool.
to know that a disability has a niche, a positive niche for
right.
it.
Right, totally.
That's a great thing to come home and be like, wow, no pity pot today, no 17 minutes because I'm nimble and I can be lifted and lofted in air, you know, doing all these really neat things.
Definitely.
And that gave you freedom. That's great because there are so many times in your life that you had multiple surgeries.
Yes.
Where, so when you weren't out there, you know, recuperating in the hospital, you're out there celebrating through dance.
Yeah.
And other arts, which is great.
Yeah. And that was always something that, you know, if I had a surgery, well, most of my surgeries have been lower extremities, you know, hips, ankles, which affected dance, you know. So I would be out of dance for however long it was. And it would always be something like, okay, I need to get better so I can get back to dance class, you know, so I can stretch and move and feel free again.
And you informed me that doctors, especially in physical therapy, would say that your recovery.
Yeah.
And or the way you responded to operations was that much better because of being an athlete and mobile and having your body well tuned.
Definitely. Definitely. My doctor was always encouraging me to move because it kept my muscles strong. You know, stretching is a huge thing, especially for people that have different skeletons like mine, because, you know, we have all these programs like yoga and all these kinds of things that are very able-bodied centered, you know. It's around how the able-bodied folk can move. And so I was able to kind of always find a way to adjust, you know, and always find a different sort of way to do the same kind of stretch. And it helped me a lot. And during recovery of surgeries, I mean, I would come back so fast compared to other peers of mine that were the same age at doing the same surgery.
Wow, that's remarkable.
Yeah, it really is.
Did you actually put any thought into that, or you're just like, oh, I'm lucky?
I actually did, I think, because my doctor at the time, I trusted a lot, and he always encouraged me to dance. So I also wanted to keep doing dance because I knew it was helping me in one way or another. I felt like it was helping me not only emotionally and mindset-wise, but physically too.
Perpetually positive.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. My name is Mark Farrell. Welcome to Insight on a Progressive Radio Network. Sophia Cheyenne is my guest today. Sophia is an amazing person. Oh, by the way, congratulations are in order.
Thank
you. 3-4 weeks of marriage.
Yes.
Yay!
Yes. Thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's been a whirlwind of a year. Family and planning a wedding is like, it's like putting on a show, really.
of 10 calibers worth of show.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Exactly. But it's, yeah, had it's
you
been
thought,
a great couple of weeks.
Had you thought about marriage? And
actually,
who you would marry? Would you marry a little person or a dwarf? Had you consider that?
This is so funny because no, I never saw myself getting married at all.
Because
you know, it wasn't. I think for the most part, every time that I tried to pursue a relationship or I liked someone, I was always kind of put in the friend zone. And
I like you, but I'd
yeah,
rather prefer
like you're
to
cute,
be...
pat on the head.
No.
Yeah, you know, and it wasn't that I didn't have good guy friends, because I do, but it just seemed like they couldn't see me as a woman or sexy or, you know, just something beyond just my height.
And you got it going on, girl.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're doing video as well, so it's not just my opinion. People can concur.
I never really saw it for myself. I didn't think that it wasn't possible, but it wasn't something that I, like, focused on and harped on. Relationships weren't a big deal to me. I valued my family more. I valued my friendships more.
Great.
And it was always something like, oh, if it happens, great. And I'm glad that I sort of had that maturity, because I think that high school probably would have been a lot harder if I was more focused on relationships like most other people were. But yeah, for me, it was just about, you know, living your life fully and having fun and making friends.
The way it should be.
Yeah.
That's great. Good for
yeah.
you. So you met your husband through LPA?
I did.
Little People of America?
Yes. Little People of America. Wonderful organization. Lots of resources. There's still so much work as an organization I feel like we have to do. But I met him there. And it's funny because even another layer of that is I never thought I would marry a little person to say that, because, you know, normal, I'm surrounded by average height people more than I am little people. You know, the only time I saw lots of little people was at these conventions every summer, or at regionals, or sometimes we do like Christmas parties and little gatherings locally also. But yeah, never ever thought that I would marry a little person, let alone probably one of the most famous people in our organization, my husband, Clinton Brown. Many people know him. He's been a huge role model for a lot of people throughout his life. He's been through a lot, and his parents and his experience have been something that many people admired, you know, and really were like, wow, if he can get through it, I can, you know.
And he has his own form of challenges.
He does.
He actually stands about a foot shorter than you at
yes.
coming in at 3'3"?
3'3", yeah.
And
yeah.
you are 4?
I'm 4'1", 4'1 and a half, yeah. His dwarfism is different than mine. It's called diastrophic dysplasia, and it's actually even rarer than mine. I think there's only like 300 of them in the world.
In the world?
Yeah, yeah. So the likelihood of that, and this is what's fascinating about his, is because his is a recessive gene, and because it's recessive, you have to have two of them to pass down in order for that.
Hence the rareness.
Right. And his parents are average height, both of them. So for the likelihood of them finding each other and then each of them having this recessive gene and then passing it, it's really a miracle. I mean, I think it's fate, you know. So people like him are very special, because it's just you don't meet someone like him. And his energy is just dynamic. He is a go-getter. He is so smart. I mean, he works so hard to do what he does. And he's really, like, the life that we have is because of how hard he's worked in his life.
Oh, fantastic.
It's really, I feel so lucky and grateful.
And that's dealing with a lot of injuries and surgeries
yeah.
and ambulatory. I mean, he gets around certainly well,
he does.
But I mean, it's not without effort.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And
for
he's been driving for years, and you looked up to him. You didn't get your driver's license until 2 years ago?
Yep, about 2 years
ago. And not just because of your height, because you live in New York City area, and it's a secondary, tertiary, way down the list.
Yeah, exactly.
I need a car? Yeah, right.
And honestly, what really pushed me to get a car was because I was with him. I was in a relationship with him, and he lives in Long Island. And I was like, well, you know, if I ever want to visit him, or if I end up moving there, which I did, I need a car, you know? So, and he drove, and he really made it seem like, oh, it's possible. As long as you think it's possible, it is. And it's all about putting your mind to it and making it happen.
Yes. And with the, obviously, modern technology, with advances, extensions, et cetera.
And, lots of cars today are helpful in that way, especially for people
adaptable with
different abilities, but still, there's still a way. You got to think creatively, you got to think outside the box to make it right for you, because no one person is the same.
No, of course not. So this is great. You found the love of your life in the sphere of a world you existed in already.
Yeah.
And it's great. And yet you're in different directions as well. You're a teacher. You love the arts. You still perform, et cetera. And you love positively impacting people's lives through speaking to teens, a lot of them who've been through run-ins with trouble. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to obviously show them, listen, embrace and celebrate people's differences. This is my life story. I look different. Yeah. And thankfully, because we don't all want to look the same, homogenous is not good. I remember people would say, how do you like living in Hoboken? I'm like, it's great. It's like the sixth borough of New York, but it's a little bit too homogenous, diversity in life is good, and diversity comes in all shapes, sizes, and abilities and not.
Yeah.
And that's a fantastic thing that you have embraced this and realized that, what was the Wizard of Oz that when you saw that movie, just... You said to yourself, this is my calling.
Yeah. Yeah. I had seen a production of it at my school. I think I was about 10 years old. And it was just so fun and captivating. And I was like, whoa, this is something that I can see myself doing. And I had already been on the stage because I danced. So it didn't seem like this out of the blue idea. It was just like presented in front of me. And I was like, this is great. And I honestly haven't looked back since. Being on the stage really just makes me feel whole. And now that I'm older and when I went to college and I really got a good training, I also learned that storytelling can change people. And it can help the world, I believe, by just opening up my story to everyone who's listening now, or what you do. Sharing our stories can actually just make someone think a little differently about something so small that can turn into something else, like the butterfly effect, And I think that that is magical. And so being a storyteller is kind of, now it feels like it's the only way to live.
And you do it so well. That little synopsis right there.
Thank you.
On the edge of my seat. Very well done. Do you think if dwarfism wasn't part of your makeup that you would still be feeling the same way about being on a stage and telling your story and being just so in love with the art?
Right. That's such a good question. I mean, it's so hard to think outside of that. But my whole family is very creative and artistic. My mother dances, my dad paints, my brother can pick up any instrument and play it.
Really?
Yes. So I think that creativity would have still been there if I was average height. But maybe the passion and the drive that I have right now, which is very much from my experience, it could be slightly different, and I mean, things would have been so different. But I love thinking back on all of my experiences, and there's so many times where I was like, man, that was such a hard, that was a rough patch, And being like, but, I got to where I am because of that
exactly
rough patch.
Exactly, what it taught you. Yeah, I always say to people, like, nobody ever wants to be in a really uncomfortable situation or a period in their life. I mean, it's, you just want to, like, scream and yell and run. But when you get to the other end, it's like, wow, I can breathe. And you look back, you're like, I manage. I muddle through it. I'm resilient, and I'm a better person for it.
Yeah.
We don't like it when we're in the thick of it, but there's no snapping your fingers and getting out of it.
No, not at all. And being resilient is just such a gift. I think that it's really hard for people. I think everyone can do it, you know, but I think it
we
is.
We wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
None of us would be
Nobody
here.
Would. Yeah. Exactly. And there are times where I had to remind myself of what resilience meant, you know, because it was something that I was like, God, like you said, that thick of it is just so hard to see the other side.
Mm.
So hard.
Absolutely. Like blinders. You know, I saw something last night on HBO, and I actually wanted to talk about this before, and I'm so happy this just came up. There's a show, I think it's a series called Titans.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about incredible people, icons that have just done things and powered and plowed through their life and are successful. I was watching someone last night. I think it was... what's the music mogul's name? Jimmy Levine? Yeah. The producer. He was saying, why do you think horses, thoroughbreds, wear blinders? Because when they're wearing blinders and they're running down a track and there's horses that fall, literally fall, they can't see them.
Right.
Because when you're running for your life, whether it's at work or you're literally on a track, you know, you should be only thinking about your mechanics, your finish line, your form, your breathing, etc. But if you see people falling on the wayside, that is going to impact you mentally. Or if you're dropping back, obviously, when you get to a certain point, you're that far back, you can see people ahead of you, even when you have blinders on. But I thought that was a very, very interesting kind of analogy of how we can be as human beings competitively.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. No, I mean, I love that because I think that it is about focusing on you, you know, and focusing on what you have the power to do and what you're worth.
And not worrying about what other people are doing
or
not doing.
Yeah.
Or even if they've surpassed you. You know, you surround your people by people who you want to emulate and or, you know, catapult and, you know, your trajectory in life because, you know, I was telling my son and other younger kids that, you know, if you're always playing with people that you're better than, you know, you always want to be playing with people that you're not as good at. You know, even when I cycle a lot outside, you know, some guys I ride with that I'm on par with, some people I'm better than, and there's a few people that are better cyclists that, you know, I really got to work with hanging with them. And that's great. Those are the best workouts, and that's actually how you get to the next level in anything in life. Now, so I imagine a resiliency also stems on the... I'm talking about those hard times when you're recuperating, you know, sometimes that you were at a school for a while, especially one summer.
Yeah.
I believe that you spent a great deal of time out of school, including the summer, and you had to be homeschooled.
Yeah.
And that must have taken a toll because not only are you just obviously not doing what you want to do, dance and being in the mix of things, but, you know, you don't have that interaction, the social interaction of your peers. And
yeah.
That takes a toll.
Oh, man. I mean, that was the summer of 2009 was one of the roughest times of my life. I had a surgery on my ankles. It was supposed to be 6 weeks recovery. Turned out to be really a year and a half of you know, about 6 months bed rest, and then the rest of the time just trying to get up and walk. And it was senior year of high school, you know, you have prom, you're getting ready for college, you're trying to do all that. And I was very alone, you know, I was home. I mean, my family is my rock. My family is really the reason why I have the ability to be resilient sometimes, I feel. But
though, of course, they have lives and they were working, so you spent a great deal of time alone.
Yeah, I was very alone.
And those
alone.
Wheels can start turning, baby.
Yeah, definitely. Played lots of tricks on my mind. I mean, I journaled a lot during that time. And sometimes I read back on those journals and it's dark, man. You know, it's really dark. And I think I was just frustrated at so many things, frustrated at the medical side of things, frustrated at my own body, frustrated at, like, my creative self that wasn't being active at all. And it really, like, it made my experiences after that really low. So when I started college, I was at a really low place. Just mentally, it was hard for me to feel like I could ever come back out of it. But to be completely honest, I think that it was theater that got me out of it. I think that I remember it was my freshman semester, which was so hard. Like emotionally, you know, and physically, because I wasn't that great after that surgery physically. I ended up having to have another surgery very soon after, because I was bedridden for so long that another part of my body had gotten so stiff that I had to address that.
Atrophy, I'm sure, set in.
Yeah. And so, like, on top of, you know, all that stuff was really tough. But, yeah, I was freshman semester of college, and I saw an audition notice, and I hadn't been on the stage at that point in, like, 2 years. And I was like, all right, fine. And so I did it. I got a role. I got nominated to be a part of a college festival that then brought me to the finals of this festival, where I almost had an opportunity to perform at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C.
Fantastic.
And it was that experience that really made me feel like this is where I am at home, you know, and I feel so at peace when I'm doing this. And really, that was the turning point for me. And I was able to find my way back to myself through theater.
And that was in your first 2 years at the community college?
Yeah.
Before you went to finish out your dual major?
Yes.
In BFA, get your BFA, and also psychology.
Yeah, yeah. So then after that, I went to Brooklyn College, CUNY school, woohoo.
Yay.
And I double majored there. I got accepted into an acting program, a 3-year program, very intense program, just like a conservatory that you would go to, but it's not a conservatory, but very intense training. And there I learned what kind of artist I want to be. I knew I wanted to be an artist, but what kind of artist? And that's really catapulted me into where I'm at now, which is sharing my story, you know, and using my experiences as a way to bounce ideas off of other people and create new work and also teach and be a good role model for younger kids, too.
When you were at Brooklyn College, were your professors very positive in saying you can do this, or was never even a consideration just because you were there and you were in a program? Obviously, prove to them that this is something you want to do very seriously,
yeah.
And whether you want to do it as a career or not, but this is why you're here.
I definitely had to prove myself, I feel like, because, you know, the arts... The entertainment industry is already a beast, you know. And so what I definitely did learn in college, what I didn't learn when I was younger and in high school, was how tough it's going to be mm-hmm. in the real world, especially for someone that is differently abled.
And how thick your skin must be.
Yes, yes. And I did. I had to develop really thick skin through experiences at the college. And, you know, there was one particular experience where I felt like I had to fight for a role that I deserved, and to be seen in that way, and I was able to get through that with so much power and so much grace. Like I did the role. It was Miss Julie by August Strindberg, very very famous play, and it was a tough experience because it's a huge role, it's an iconic role, but also. It was something that I felt like I had to fight for, and yeah, developing that tough skin is was a great skill that I learned in college too.
And the dual major psychology, did you ever think that you were going to go into the field of psychology, or is this for your own edification?
You know, I did actually think that I could go into the field of psychology. I took an intro to psychology class at my community college, and I was just like, this is so cool, the brain is amazing, part of the brain and that part of the brain, you know, and I was really fascinated by it. And then I was able to take classes that were just like interesting, like family dynamics,
sure.
or you know, behavior and all sorts of stuff. And so when I had learned about what drama therapy is, which is sort of an integration of the two, you know, acting, storytelling, and being a therapist, that those two things combined can actually really help people, I was like, wow, there's really something to this. And the funny thing about that is that my high school college counselor told me, you should look into drama therapy. And this was many years before I was in college. And I was like, drama therapy, what's that? That's weird, you know. And years later, that is what I ended up being super interested in.
And that brings us to today.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Good for you for impacting so many lives and teens. It's great. We're almost out of time. But looking back, I mean, would you have felt that or thought that, number one, at 26, you would be married to someone who also shares dwarfism traits as you and so successful and happy, most importantly, happy about who you are and who you're becoming?
Yeah, I always saw myself as having a happy and fulfilling life. But being here now today, I would have never imagined that I would be where I am, especially at my age, living very happily with someone that I love so much that we have complete opposite interests, but support each other.
I think that works well.
It does.
My wife and I have a lot of opposite interests.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, we support each other so much, and it's so much love and just full of positivity and light, and I'm just so grateful for where I've what I've done and how I've gotten here.
And finally, you're on the you co-chair a position on the Little People of America.
Yes, yes, I'm the chair of the Artist Coalition, and it's been such a fun experience so far. But I'm just happy to be a part of the organization and help it grow.
And where are you in 10 years from now? Let's do
Ooh.
5 years.
Five years.
In 10 seconds or less.
Okay, well, I definitely hope I have a major role in
Off-Broadway?
A feature film.
Feature film.
Yep.
Yes. And your website is?
SophiaCheyenne.com. That's SofiaCheyenne.
You are so remarkable. I'm so thrilled to have the chance to meet you and to know you.
It's been so nice to meet you. Thank you for having me. It's been great.
This is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. To have me speak, you're a school, college, corporation, and more. Check out MarkFarrellMotivation.com. MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Gary Noel's next. Stay cool. Have a great day. Okay.